Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight grew up in Omaha, Nebraska, and is an Emmy Award-winning musician and composer. He began his 30-year career creating music for early MTV bumpers and the pivotal fire dance scene in the Oscar-winning film Dances with Wolves. He's released 15 records to date, is the author of Life is What You Make It, and is also the son of legendary investor Warren Buffett. His name, Peter Buffett. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasula, and we're with musician, composer, author, producer, and philanthropist, Peter Buffett. Peter, welcome. An honor to have you.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Peter, we all know about your famous dad, Warren, the Oracle of Omaha.
Right.
But tell us about your mom.
Thank you for that. Yes, my dad gets all the accolades because in the world we happen to live in, what he's done is extraordinary, and it is. But my mother is equally extraordinary. In the book, I call her the Dolly Mama. and I do that because she had a phenomenal way of bringing compassion and understanding to so many relationships. It was really extraordinary. So growing up, I saw her interact with people from the other side of town, the other side of the world. I'd walk home from public school, you know, to have lunch in elementary school, and she'd be there at the table. And what I learned from her, really, is that everyone has something to teach. She was such a great listener. It was extraordinary.
What's the biggest thing you learned from your dad?
Well, I learned that if you are lucky enough to find something you love, you should definitely do it, and that perseverance, you know, focus and almost kind of a monastic quality around just diving into it and loving it so much and being focused on it so much can reap great rewards, but it's really not the money. You know, he's such the perfect example of someone who loves what they do and could care less about the money, other than it tells him he's doing a good job. He likes that idea that he's got a ruler, a yardstick to tell him, boy, you must be doing something right because look at all this money over here. But he doesn't spend it because that's not what's important. It's just important to be doing the work that he loves so much.
We're talking to Peter Buffett. Peter, your dad is famous for the ukulele.
Right.
You started playing the piano as an infant. Tell us about that.
Well, for me, I like to kind of put it in the perspective of I grew up in a loving household, which made it a safe household for a child. And my mother grew up two blocks away. So my grandparents lived there when I was, all through my childhood. And so I would walk to my grandparents' house as soon as I could learn how to look both ways to cross the street. And so I had this very safe, loving environment. And that allowed my mind to go other places. I wasn't worried about the basics. And again, that has nothing to do with money. That has to do with love and support for who I was. And so my mind would wander, and it would go off in creative directions. And for whatever reason, I would hear music in my head, and I'd come home and try and bang it out on the piano from the time I can remember. And, you know, it's funny because my dad and my mother both were quite musical, very musical. And but they never, you know, it was a generation where you certainly didn't take that too seriously. You did it for fun as a hobby. And I kind of looked at it that way, too, as I was growing up. This is just a fun way to express myself and meaningful way as well. You know, it was important for me to go to the piano and get out my feelings that way.
A lot of people assume, Peter, because of your dad's wealth, that you just had an easy life. But I want to quote you on something. You say, the support, the privilege really comes from having two parents that said and believed that I could do anything.
Right.
That support didn't come in the form of a check. That support came in the form of love and nurturing and respect for us finding our way, falling down, figuring out how to get up ourselves. Talk to us about so many parents today, they want to give the kid everything.
Right, right. And it's, you know, the simplest thing I can say is if you give a child a crutch when they're learning to walk, they're never going to learn to walk. And my parents, again, were so loving and supportive. And, you know, we hear stories all the time of people coming from difficult backgrounds and making a great life for themselves in some way, becoming a leader, all these things. I will guarantee you that if not all, most had parents that supported them and believed in them, you know, and money cannot buy that. And at the same time, you know, money can buy these crutches, you know, this idea that, oh, gee, you know, you need help, I better solve it with a check. And I can tell you that again, my own mistakes in my life that have been financial, I have come out of them myself and been stronger for it. Look back and went, boy, my parents actually respect me. Not only do they love me, but they respect the idea that I can figure this out myself. And that's how you grow and how you learn. You can't possibly only have successes.
As a follow-on to those mistakes, at 19, your dad gave you $90,000 worth of Berkshire Hathaway stock, which would be worth millions today, Peter Buffett.
Yep.
What did you do with it?
Well, that actually came in the form of an inheritance from my grandfather, because quite honestly, I'm not sure my dad would have given me $90,000 at college. But my grandfather left all of us grandchildren a farm. My dad reinvested that in Berkshire Hathaway stock. He sold the farm. And in fact, when I was 19, I got this $90,000, and it would be worth at least $70 million today. And so what I did with that money is I was at a crossroads in terms of my college life and trying to decide what I really wanted to do, and it was apparent to me for the first time, honestly, that music might really be it. My parents knew I loved music, always played music, and encouraged me, actually, to take the money and spend some of it, you know, do it wisely. My dad helped me kind of think through how much I might have to spend, and I was a college kid. I didn't need much. And buy time, ultimately. You know, the most precious thing we have, really, is time, because you can't replace it. And so I bought time. I also bought a little equipment for my studio so I could realize this potential dream. And I moved up to San Francisco and essentially invested in myself. And so I am sort of living proof of what I call your money or your life. You know, I could have had just a pile of money based on someone else's success, or I could have built my own. And, of course, I chose the latter. I built my own and am much happier having done that than just have a big bank account.
And the world is better for it.
Yeah.
We're talking to Peter Buffett. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula, and we're with Peter Buffett, Emmy Award-winning musician and composer. Peter, talk to us about the magic of music.
Well, I'll tell you, it is magical, and I sort of never get over that fact. Because it came naturally to me, I never really fully realized just how powerful it can be. Of course, you see it in all sorts of ways all the time, but it really brings it home when I'm out performing and get the feedback from people I'm performing for. There's something about the fact that it is just this vibration coming out into the world, you know, these various frequencies, these songs, that allow people to go other places in their heads, their memories, their futures, their, you know, all these different things. It is magical. And I can't tell you why that is, but I can tell you that it's true.
Every great musician has to find his or her sound.
Right.
How did you do that?
Well, I worked at it, and at the same time, work is sort of the correct word and completely wrong, because you have to, work sounds like it's a labor, and while there's a lot of time spent kind of listening to your own voice, essentially, it's I relate it to some ways as just a brand, you know, something where people say, that's, I know that sound and I know where it comes from and it makes me feel good or whatever it might do. But everybody in their own way, regardless of who they are, what they do, has to find their own voice, their unique place in the world, their potential, who they are. And the sound for a musician is that same thing. It's like, who am I? And what is it that's unique about what I'm putting out there? And that does take time. I mean, I have developed the sound, and in fact, I've sort of come up with a couple different ones, which confuses my listeners because they hear kind of a new age quality to a lot of my work, the instrumental work. Then there's the American Indian work that kind of took that to a different level, and now my more straight ahead kind of pop songwriting. But they're all related to me, but they're different sounds out in the world.
Everybody that's successful has had luck. Luck is when preparation meets up with opportunity. I think Lee Trevino said, the harder I practiced, the luckier I got. Well, you worked hard, but your first scoring of a film was Dances with Wolves with Kevin Costner. How did that happen?
Right, and I'll tell you, that's a great quote, the Lee Trevino quote, because you work hard, and then, you know, Steve Jobs said that you can only connect the dots in retrospect. So in other words, you look back and you go, wow, okay, all that hard work led me to something, and what a moment. And for me, Dances with Wolves was actually an example of both luck and missed opportunity because I wasn't completely prepared. It's an interesting combination because I had set out a few years before Dances with Wolves to think about how I could move beyond writing music for commercials. And I thought that film and television would be a great next step. I knew that instrumental music was being used by film editors to get music into film, just to edit to, you know, and then a director would hear that music and think, wow, that's great music, let's hire that person. So I knew that if I put music out there in the world that it might get heard and picked up by an editor or a director. I was lucky enough to get a record deal. I put some instrumental records out. You know, this again is years in the making. and then I heard that Kevin Costner was making this movie, and I went, this is the perfect combination. My second record had a lot of emotions and American Indian-filled music, not so much literally musically like drums and flutes and things you might expect, but the emotions after I had read a book that really inspired the second record. And so Kevin heard my music, and the luck there was that I had remembered that I had gone to school, to college, with a guy who married a woman whose father was Costner's agent's best friend. So that was the luck. That was the amazing thing, that I could actually get my music to Kevin, because that's not easy, and he loved it and asked me to score the whole film. And that's where the other side comes in. I was not prepared to actually score an entire epic film. I had never done it before, and I really didn't have the craft of doing that. And so I lost out on the film, but I ended up getting what many consider to be the pivotal, you know, most important scene in the film. And so, as luck would have it, both the, you know, the beauty of how that worked out in my favor, and also the fact that, you know, I wasn't totally prepared to take on the whole job.
We're talking to Peter Buffett, the youngest son of Warren, who 5 years ago, in his 13th album, Gold Star in 2006, decides to start to sing.
Right.
Why?
Well, I had gone through a lot of complex things in my life. I tried to create, and did actually create, a show called Spirit the Seventh Fire, a massive undertaking, very ambitious. I had to go out and raise money and mortgage my house, and I did all these things to realize this dream, and it stressed everything in my life. I will not say that going for a big dream is easy, but it was necessary for all sorts of reasons in my life. And afterwards, and actually during, in 2004, just about a week after the premiere of this show that I'd spent years trying to get off the ground, my mother passed away. And a year after that, my very best friend from Omaha passed away. And so in 2005, I found myself in New York. We had moved, my wife and I had moved to New York, and my life was upside down in a lot of ways. And I realized that I needed to sing. I phrase it in a way where I learned what sing your heart out really means. I had no choice. Music was always the vehicle to connect to my emotions, and at this point I just needed to sing it out. And so Gold Star, I started in 2005, and then it was released the next year, and it was me putting my heart right out there through my voice.
Your music today, and I quote, "Now there's some meat on the bone. I've tried to go a little deeper than just holding hands," to quote the Beatles.
Right.
So your songs today have causes. Tell us about the song, "Can We Love?"
Well, yeah, and thank you for quoting that, because I really, the Beatles were such a huge influence. And at the same time, as they evolved through their career, you know, John Lennon ends up putting up billboards, "War is over if you want it." You know, I mean, you grow in all ways, and you get more connected to the outside world. And "Can We Love" is both a very personal song that I wrote just as a relationship to my wife, but also it really brings up a much bigger theme for me, and it's really the impetus behind it. And when I was 5 or 6, you know, again, the Beatles were on Ed Sullivan, and it changed my life. But the other thing that changed my life was seeing these images coming out of Selma and other cities in the South of people turning fire hoses on other people. And when you're a kid and you see that, it's just, it's stunning beyond that word. I don't know what the word is, but it burns these images in your mind, and it just made no sense. And now, as I'm an adult and I'm doing more philanthropy work and all of that, and I see what goes on here and around the world, and I'm thinking, what's it going to take? And it seems so simple. And maybe it's as simple as the billboard saying "War is over." You know, we can change this, but it's going to take all of us. And "Can We Love" seemed like the most obvious question. Can we do this, please? Because I think it's time and it's necessary.
And here's a little of the song, "Can We Love." We're talking to Peter Buffett. I'm Jack Rasula. Can we love? And this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible. And we're talking to Peter Buffett, the author of Life Is What You Make It. Peter, you really have fallen in love with our nation's first people, Native Americans. Tell us about Native Americans.
Well, I really started this relationship when I was in my late 20s, when I read a book called Son of the Morning Star. And what struck me is that I had never learned any of this stuff in school. And I think now kids are learning more about how the country was sort of built and manifest destiny and all these things. And there is the kind of cruel and difficult side, but what I looked at is Americans that had been here from the beginning, and of course they weren't Americans, and indigenous people in this country were here for thousands and thousands of years, and they probably had so, and I know they have so much to teach us about how to live in connection. And I'm not romanticizing it. You know, everybody's got problems. But indigenous people really all over the world have a relationship to the world around them, a connection, an interaction. that we are sorely missing, and I think is now playing out in so many ways. We are so disconnected in so many ways to the land we live on, the people around us. And so for me, the story was important to get out there in terms of that disconnection and how Indigenous people are the closest thing we have to remembering who we all were. I mean, we all came from a tribe at some point, and it seems that we've been running away from that for so long, and there's just so much there. There's so much knowledge that we have to get back to.
Let's go on to your book, Life is What You Make It, Find Your Own Path to Fulfillment, New York Times bestseller. Chapter 2, No One Deserves Anything. Easy for you to say, Peter. Your dad is Warren Buffett.
Right. And that's how I start my show as well. When I hold up the book or when I talk at a bookstore, I say, okay, life is what you make it. My last name, easy for you to say. And I think the point is that we don't. I mean, my dad is the first one to say that he's won the ovarian lottery, as have I. And the meaning, of course, is that I don't think, last I checked anyway, I didn't have a say in where I was born, what time I was born, the parents I was born to. These are extraordinary things. And to think of someone being entitled, that's the worst thing in the world to me. I mean, that is one of the worst words, is any sort of entitlement, that just because you were born into a certain country, a family, a race, a religion, anything, that you're somehow entitled to something. We were all born into whatever we were born into, not by choice, and so no one comes out deserving something. We all have to make our own way and find our path.
Another chapter, Peter Buffett, of the book, Don't Just Find Your Bliss, Do Your Bliss. Please.
Well, again, not everybody can find that what they love is how they make a living. But by doing it in some way, by finding your bliss, which that's hard enough in a world that tells us we have to strive for this, or we're no good if we don't have this, or we've got all these messages coming. And if we can sort all that out and listen to ourselves and say, but what really excites me, what turns me on, then if you do that, regardless, even if you have to go to the day job in order to do what you love in the evening or the weekends, you're still being more authentic to yourself. And I think that's what it gets down to. If we can live out of an authentic place that's real for us, that's going to resonate out to our children and our friends and our family. And it has a different feeling, and it changes, I think, the world, frankly, if you can feel like you're whole, like you're really living an authentic life.
Chapter 10, Peter Buffett, is What We Mean When We Say Success.
Well, and again, I think I'm as good as anybody to say I've seen success. My father is considered extremely successful. And I will tell you that if you walked in that house tonight, you would see the same scene you saw in 1965. You'd see him probably in a bathrobe eating a ham sandwich reading. And so success is not multiple houses and a big TV and all these things. It's doing something you love and not needing really much else except, family and friends and love in your life. And so that's where I feel like if anybody can speak to success, I think I'm probably pretty good at it.
Peter, your dad, Warren, still lives in the same house that you grew up in Omaha. How has he stayed so humble?
Well, it's been very easy because I don't know how to articulate it best, but he's just somebody who is wired a certain way that he can do what he loves every day. And so he doesn't really look beyond that. He considers himself very fortunate, and maybe that's part of the humbleness, actually, is that he's self-reflective and says, wow, I'm so lucky that I get to do this. What else do I need? Nothing, And so he doesn't look, he's not trying to fill up some hole in his psyche by saying, look at me, look how great I am. I mean, the world's doing that for him, frankly. They're telling him how great he is. So he gets it. It's not like he doesn't have an ego, but he doesn't need anything else. And so to stay in the house that I grew up in, you know, that since 1958 he's been in this house, and that's because it's a place where he can sleep, and it's a roof over his head, and he doesn't need anything else. Very simple.
Peter Buffett, as we begin this new decade, your epilogue of the book says, begin it now.
Yes, and I love the fact that we're talking here just, you know, right after the new year, and we have a whole, not only new year, new decade, new life to look forward to. And commitment is everything. I mean, nothing happens without initiative. Even sometimes, you know, saying, I don't want to take part in that is doing something. You're actively saying, no, this is not what I want anymore. I want to do something else. But commitment is key. Without it, zero happens. And even if it's the wrong commitment, you learn something from it, and then you can adjust accordingly. So that's why I end the book that way, because nothing's going to happen at all if you don't make the move.
Have you talked to your dad about this new decade and his thoughts or insights about it?
Well, you know, I haven't much yet, but I look forward to it. And the reason why I haven't is because my dad is so phenomenally consistent and stable. And now he's, you know, he just turned 80 last year. And he's really looking at, hey, you know, this is my life and how I've lived, and I'm enjoying it. And he's, in a sense, like all of us get, I think, as we get older, set in his ways. Not to say that he isn't changing and growing and learning all the time, because I think he still is, which keeps him vital. But it's sort of like at some point that handoff where I'm thinking a lot more, I think, about the next decade than he is. In some ways, he's just going to keep doing what he does.
We're talking to Peter Buffett, and here's a little bit of his song, Set Us Free. That's Set Us Free by Peter Buffett, and I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula, and we're with musician, composer, author, producer, and philanthropist, Peter Buffett. Peter, June 29th, 2006, your dad decides to donate $37 billion to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and he gives you and Jennifer $1 billion for you to set
right.
up. What did he say when he gave you the billion? Did he tell you what to do with it?
Well, basically, no. He wrote a letter that's actually public online saying basically that he believed in myself and my two siblings, that we would do the right thing. Obviously, this was $1 billion. To give away. It wasn't for us. It was to say, here's an addition to your foundation. We had a small one before just to kind of learn the ropes. And basically said, the only real directive was try and do things that no one else is doing. Go places that are difficult or not being paid attention to. And that was really more a suggestion, I would say. He really said, this is yours, do it. And so that's what we spent the next few years after that date in 2006 doing is actually learning a lot and trying to find where those hard places were.
It started out the Novo Foundation, and I think now it's, is there something I can do?
Well, the Novo Foundation is the entity that Jennifer is president of and that we are co-chairs of, and that's the real foundation. Is There Something I Can Do is a project that I did with ACON, actually, that that came out of working on a couple of songs with him, and that's more a specific place to go, mostly for younger people if they're interested in getting involved in philanthropy. So that's sort of an offshoot more from my career working in the music side than the Novo Foundation, which is the actual work we're doing with my dad's gift.
You and Akon are with DoSomething.org.
Right.
And talk to us about human trafficking.
Well, that's really the kind of darkest corner of our world today and so prevalent. I was not really aware of it at all until our work at the Novo Foundation and going to Calcutta in particular, a place in that city where we saw thousands and thousands of girls being trafficked as sex slaves, and talking to a 15-year-old girl who had escaped and hearing her story and realizing this happens over and over everywhere, you know, right here where I am in New York City, all around the country, all around the world. And once you learn this and you start to talk to people who have been through the experience, again, you can't forget it, and you have to do something about it. And if we're going to create a more balanced, loving world, the first thing we have to stop is putting price tags on people's heads, I think.
Another thing that you're focused on is female empowerment. Talk to us about adolescent girls being the undervalued asset of the world.
Right, and I frame that in the fact that, you know, my dad's success is based on identifying undervalued assets and just supporting them and letting them do their thing, and the market finally realizes the value. And in fact, an adolescent girl, as I have learned, is clearly the most efficient investment you can make with your support, dollars, time, whatever it might be. They are the only people that will be the mother of every child. No one can dispute that. And because of their inherent nature in terms of being future mothers, they have a quality about them that will almost across the board, and this is backed up with a lot of research, is that you give a girl or a young woman a dollar or support in any way, and she will turn that back into something for herself, her family, her community. It goes in the right places to make the world a better place. And supporting girls really does have a ripple effect that can potentially change the world.
A few years ago, I had the famous Father Ted Hesburgh, the legendary Notre Dame president, who's 93, 94. He's done phenomenal things in his life. And I said, if you had one more big dream in you, what would it be? And he said, oh, Jack, teach every woman on earth an education.
Wow.
Because they educate the kids.
Right.
And so many of the problems of war, et cetera, would go away if we educated every woman.
Yep, absolutely. I believe it 100%.
A new year, a new decade. And here in Michigan, it's been a tough decade for us. And people come and see opportunity, Peter, but so many of us, we see the obstacles. Are you hopeful about the future of America?
I am, but I'm hopeful if, in fact, we can find the opportunities, because it is very easy to look at the various institutional structures and things that we're in and think that that's just the way it is and that's the way it's always been and going to be. And, of course, as things shift so dramatically as they have over the past couple of years, you think, well, maybe this isn't true, but how do I reimagine a future? And there are so many people reimagining the future actually out there. And I think it really gets down to certainly personal responsibility in terms of thinking, who am I really? What do I really want to do? Where's the opportunity for me? And then community. The most important thing is community. There have been transformations in various small towns around the country because of this financial crisis, and they've been positive. I mean, there's certainly been some difficult transformations, but there are ways out of it, but it takes true imagination, real leadership, people that are willing to take chances and not say necessarily the things that that might get them elected, but might get them into, you know, doing something important for the community. And so, yes, I'm hopeful, but it takes real, true leadership, people willing to take risks, and other people that are willing to imagine along with them, you know, a different kind of community and environment.
People who know you well say, wow, he's just a good down-to-earth person, and he is a great listener. How do we learn to become a great listener?
Well, it takes putting ourselves aside for just a minute, all of our preconceived notions, our biases, and actually open up and realize that you might have something to learn from someone else, and really, you know, really truly believing that. I have found so many times where I've had an opinion about someone or a thought about someone, and then I listen to them a little further, I get to know them a little better, and I'm constantly surprised. I'm like, wow, I had no idea. And so it really takes putting yourself aside a little bit and all the stuff that comes with, you know, your particular bias or conception of what's right and wrong.
As our time winds down tonight, Peter Buffett, what advice would you give to our young listeners?
Well, I sometimes put it in the idea of signal to noise, because I'm a recording person, right? So you always want to get the strongest signal and the least amount of noise for a recording. And when I look at the world today and what young people face, it's an awful lot of noise. It's noise from, you know, billboards and their peers and their, you know, all these things telling them what they should be, how they should dress, all this stuff. And if you can get rid of all the noise and listen to the signal, really pay attention to who you are, your voice, what's inside, and focus on that. And how can you turn that into a life and into, you know, a dream and realize the dream? That's, I think, the best advice I can give.
Peter Buffett, your dad has much to be proud of. One of the biggest is his youngest son, you.
Thank you so much.
Keep making him proud every day.
Thank you.
Thanks for all you do. Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening. And make it a great week and a great new year and a great decade. Because with God, anything is possible. Spohol.